This is an ABC podcast.
This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
A very good afternoon. Jane McNaughton here with you today on the Country Hour. A livestock industry analyst has released an updated forecast suggesting that the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator could slump even further, while heavy lamb prices could also drop. The Murray-Darling Basin Authority has announced there are several options to help reduce the impacts of the sand build-up near Echuca, which reduces the flow by more than 2,000 megalitres a day. And nearly 2 months on, since varroa mite was detected in New South Wales at the Port of Newcastle, authorities still don't know where it came from. If you'd like to send me a text, 0467 842 722. Up first today, let's see what's making rural news. Good afternoon, Emma Field.
Thanks, Jane. Making rural news. An outback Queensland mayor is calling for a review into powerful committees that decide a shire's drought status. The secretive local drought committees report to the state agricultural minister, helping to decide which regions retain its drought declaration and the financial support that goes along with it. Flinders Shire Mayor Jane McNamara says a decision to lift the drought status in her area was premature and she wants the system explained.
I think that's very important that they actually update the whole system. It's not that I'm asking for Flinders to be put back onto the drought list, it's just that I think that the system is quite flawed and it's probably not giving a true picture of what's happening in the district.
The exotic pest known as fall armyworm, which was first discovered in the Northern Territory back in March 2020, has now spread across the country. Entomologist Brian Thistleton says they now have a much better idea which crops the pest likes to feed on.
It's right through the territory. We've had it right down as far as Alice Springs. Australia-wide, it's got right down to Victoria. And as you know, in the States, it's found in Florida and Texas during the winter and migrates right up to the Canadian border during the summer. And the same thing's happening in Australia, that during the winter months it will only be up in the north and during the summer it's going right down south and attacking a whole range of crops.
Yeah, what sort of stories are you hearing?
I mean, we were initially worried because it's got a recorded host list of 350 plants. But the main hosts are grasses, and it's turned out in the territory that what we're worried about is sweet corn, maize, sorghum, Rhodes grass grown for hay, and millet and things like that. Not so much on vegetables, but we have found it on okra recently.
And staying in the north, mango flowering is in full swing throughout Queensland, with predictions of a bumper crop. At Muchaba in far north Queensland, Raymond Bin is experiencing his biggest flowering in 2 years. But there are some concerns. He may struggle to pick and transport the large crop.
There seems to be quite heavy flowering this year throughout the district, and I've heard other areas have got good flowering. So, yeah, this year looks like it could be a big one. The last 2 years I've been down 40 and 60%. So this year, it's up to now, it's basically almost like a normal crop, I'd say probably even bigger. And most farmers would say most of their varieties seem to be pushing out quite hard with flowering.
Well, that's great news, but is there a sort of a downside to it that you were sort of alluding to earlier?
Oh, look, I guess my concern is you've got to be able to pick the crop. So I guess workforce is definitely the main concern, because the last 2 years I know I've struggled with crops that were only 60 and 40% the size of this year. So, yeah, this year was such a big crop, and I don't know if the workforce is back to where it was pre-COVID. So that's probably the biggest concern. And then, like, there has been mentioned that there could be issues this year with them having enough trucks to move the produce to.
Over to South Australia now, where a parliamentary inquiry has been launched into the viability of the biochar industry. Biochar is a charcoal made from plant materials and agricultural waste, which can be used as an additive in soils to store carbon and improve nutrients. South Australian MP Leo Bignall says they want to know the potential of the industry for the state.
It's in its infancy, even though we think this has probably been around in some form or another for centuries. It's really, if you look at a South Australian perspective, probably just the past 5 to 10 years where people are starting to really implement it here. So, and we want to know, well, what is the potential here? But also, are there any barriers? Are there any, is there anything holding back, you know, the growth of biochar? Because it ticks a lot of boxes. I mean, A, you get rid of what would normally be waste, and as you said, could just be left there to rot, or if you go to landfill. So you get it transformed into something that then can be used to improve soils. It the process creates heat, so you can use it to generate power in some instances. So we see a lot of upsides in it, but like a lot of people, we don't have a true understanding of what it's all about.
And for today, that's Rural News.
Thanks so much, Emma. Emma Field there with our Rural News today. And we've already got a text in from Kevin. Good afternoon, Kevin. 5 millimetres of rain apparently at Myrtleford, just enough to keep everything saturated. We always love a rainfall text, so we can continue on with the theme from yesterday if you like. 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
A livestock industry analyst has released an updated forecast suggesting the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator could slump to a low of 765 cents per kilogram next year. Further to that, he says heavy lamb prices could also drop to 550 cents per kilogram in May before powering back into the 900 cents. This comes off the back of a recently released herd figure from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Independent analyst Simon Quilty ran Peter Somerville through his predictions for the price and herd size.
They've come in at 24.43 million in terms of the cattle herd size and the flock size at 68 million. So that all points to, one, a very healthy rebuild that's been going on in terms of the sheep flock. And so the numbers are there. I think, though, the real challenge to me, you know, we've had this dramatic drop. I think we're going to see a rebound in the next 3 to 4 weeks. But when it comes to the production of lamb, it's that the issue there is labour continues to dog the industry. In terms of cattle, it's a slightly different story. But I think the market was oversold, you might say, on the way down here. There was the scare of FMD that got a lot of publicity, but also just the sheer numbers that are now starting to come forward and the lack of labour to process them, I think is part of the reason why prices got overdone.
If we move forward 6-12 months, where do you think those prices would be at?
I think we are going to see with the lamb industry an ongoing further fall. And I have the low next year in May for heavy lambs at around 550 a kilo from, you know, today's current levels. Now, to me, this could actually be the low for several years. And so part of that is due to that ongoing expansion where we've got the flock expanding next year to around about 72 million head next year. And then the year later, a milder increase to 74 and potentially 75 in 2025. So, Peter, it's that enormous increase that we're expecting in terms of the ongoing expansion of the flock that will lead to more numbers and, as a result, you know, a bit more pressure on the pricing. The interesting counterpart of that is that demand overseas, and in particular North America, is extraordinary. And so I think that is going to help soften the landing, you might say, here. And it augurs well, I think, for the next 3 years as protein availability in North America in particular tightens on the back of their drought.
Where are we heading on the cattle front in terms of, I guess, the herd and prices?
Well, the herd is at 24.43 million head. And, you know, once again, I think the market overcorrected in recent weeks on the way down. And so my expectation is for the next 3 to 4 weeks, a bit of a rebound here. If we were just to say, look at the EYCI, the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator, I've got a rebound of back to around 940 a kilo for, around about 3 to 4 months. And then as we get into January, February of next year, we're going to see a decline in that EYCI, I think of around 765 a kilo. So that's the low, I believe, for next year. But that equates to today of around about a 15% decline off today's numbers. So, Peter, I think what's been interesting out of these figures in terms of the herd rebuild in Australia is New South Wales. New South Wales really was quite extraordinary in what it did in the 2021 year. It jumped in terms of the sheep meat numbers by a dramatic 21.3%, which almost is unheard of. And in terms of cattle, it jumped there by 15.1%. So these are extraordinary numbers for New South Wales, but highlights the severity of the drought in 2018 and 19 in New South Wales. So to me, during that year of both 20 and 2021, Peter, they begged, borrowed and stole, you might say, every animal they could, whether it was cattle or sheep, from other states. So with the cattle, it came out of Queensland, there's no doubt. And with sheep, it was Western Australia and probably Victoria where the bulk of that came from. So much so that Western Australia's sheep flock in last year actually went 7% lower than the previous year. So it has been truly challenged in its own rebuild because of the enormous buying out of New South Wales. So, Peter, with this recent correction in pricing, you've got to remember that last year and the year before, New South Wales was driving prices for both cattle and sheep because they were looking to rebuild as quickly as they could. This year, that same intensity of buying out of New South Wales for that rebuild is no longer what it was. So you might say that pressure or that extra, you know, demand that was there to me is quietened down because New South Wales, in part, has its fill.
Independent livestock industry analyst Simon Quilty speaking there with Peter Somerville.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
What's being called a sand slug that's built up in the Murray River on the New South Wales-Victorian border has reduced the river's capacity by thousands of megalitres since the 1980s. Experts say about 13 Melbourne cricket grounds full of sand has settled, but now the river managers are trying to address it. Romy Stevens spoke to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority's Andrew Reynolds about the problem.
So the Barmamillawa reaches the sort of a narrow point in the river that limits the amount of flow that can pass through, down through the river system. We've been aware of a reduction in capacity in that part of the river for some time, and over the last year or so we've been exploring the cause of that. And what we've found is that there's a significant volume of sand that's been depositing in the bed of the river, reducing the area for the water to flow through, and as a result reducing the capacity of that reach. Our studies have shown that that sand has come from land clearing and mining activities that were conducted the best part of 100 years ago and has sort of washed into the river and has progressively been moving downstream. And over the last 2 or 3 decades has been depositing in that particular reach of the river system.
What impact has this had on the local environment?
With that sand depositing in the river, we've seen the capacity of the river channel reduce from about 11,300 megalitres a day in the 1980s to about 9,200 megalitres a day now. So with that reduction in capacity, it means the river runs full for longer each year, and as a result we see erosion of riverbanks and just the river being higher for longer, which impacts on the local ecology as well.
Does it also have an impact on downstream communities?
It does. It means that the volume of water that we can pass downstream through the river itself is limited, potentially impacting the amount of water that we can provide to communities further downstream. And so we certainly have to manage very, very carefully to make sure that we've got enough water passing through the river system to meet all of the demands at various points along the river.
Can you tell me about the 6 flow options that have been identified during investigations?
Yeah, so we've looked at 6 different options that could either protect the river from further erosion or increase the capacity of the river channel again. So one that we're looking at is to do works to stabilise the riverbanks, to either encourage the revegetation or potentially put rock beaching in isolated locations to prevent further erosion. We're looking at options to potentially remove some of the sand from the river channel by dredging. That's a very significant undertaking, and we need to explore all of the challenges, both the ecological and impacts on cultural heritage and other things around that. There's something like 20 million cubic metres of sand deposited in that reach of the river, so removing it all is certainly not possible, but removing it at key locations that might impact the flow capacity of the river could help. We're looking at potentially changing the timing of water delivery from Lake Victoria down to Lake Victoria to better line that up with when the environment needs water. We're also looking at options to pass water either through the Murray Irrigation Channel Network on the New South Wales side or the Goulburn-Murray Irrigation District on the Victorian side to be able to bypass water around that narrow reach of the river and deliver it back into the river system further downstream. And lastly, we're looking at an option that potentially we might be able to use the Snowy scheme and deliver water into the Murrumbidgee, which then flows back to the Murray downstream of the Barmer-Millawa Reach. All of those options have some challenges with them, but we think a solution is likely to be a combination of a mix of those, and we're working through that now.
Can you go into some more details about what the next steps will be?
So we're working through the detail of some of these options. We've published an initial scoping study so people can be aware of the sorts of options that we're looking at. We're now working through some of the engineering details of those, and we'll take forward recommendations to government later in the year for the options that we think have the most merit, and then get some advice from water ministers as to the options they'd like us to take forward into more detailed investigations.
Executive Director of River Management with the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, Andrew Reynolds, speaking there with Romy Stevens. And CEO of the Almond Board of Australia, Tim Jackson, says this is a step in the right direction to address a critical issue.
The Almond Board was in the process of actually doing a feasibility study about this 12 months ago. So the fact that the Murray-Darling Basin Association authorities got on and got the job done is critical to irrigators and communities below the choke.
And I understand you recently, the Almond Board recently actually conducted its own tour of the area. What did you identify while you were on site?
The fact that the Barmer choke is very narrow, and that I noticed in one of the options here is stabilising the banks to prevent further incursion into the Barmer and Millawa forest. I think that's a no-brainer. Fragile's not doing it justice as to this inverted bank that snakes its way through the forest there and needs work, and it's probably a similar story in some sections of the Goulburn River as well.
So are there some options that you think have more potential than others?
I think that there's a lot of validity in all those options, and it might be a combination of some or all of those to provide environmental, commercial, social, all the benefits. There's a lot of merit in utilising some parts of all those options that have been put on the table.
You mentioned the benefits there, but what's at stake if the issue isn't addressed?
We're just not going to get the water through. And you can have the really frustrating situation where you've got storages further upstream full in the middle of summer, like we probably will have this year, given the fact that we've got such high river flows at the moment in storage. But you won't be able to deliver the water in a timely manner if you can only get a very small amount through the choke.
So these options are being presented to the government in December. They'll decide what should be investigated further or proceed to a business case and formal community consultation. Do you have a message to the governments?
We're in a situation where we're fortunate that water supply or water availability is not a problem. So it's a great time to get this sorted. But we can't be dilly-dallying. This needs to be sorted out and put into place as soon as possible, given the fact that we have communities downstream the next time we have dry times who will be relying on a solution to this problem.
Issues around the Murray-Darling Basin for years have been plagued by the fact that governments just can't come to a decision together on this. How hopeful are you that this actually will be a prompt process?
Well, the experience that I'm going through at the moment with Varroa might suggest that my optimism isn't high, but I would suggest that the critical nature of water security can bring the states together somehow.
And on the raw mite, which you just mentioned there, how are almond producers coping with everything at the moment with pollination?
Victoria are in a lot of trouble. The biosecurity border controls have left the Victorian orchards almost 50% down on hives that they require for pollination. So they're going with much lower stocking rates. And we're in the middle of bloom now. So we're in the lap of the gods as to whether we actually get a full pollination or reduced pollination, which could effectively cost hundreds of millions of dollars to the communities within that area.
CEO of the Almond Board of Australia, Tim Jackson, speaking with me earlier today. Jay McNaughton here with you today on the Country Hour, where it's 25 past 12. Nearly 2 months on since varroa mite was detected in New South Wales at the Port of Newcastle, authorities still don't know where it has come from. Scientists are working on genomic testing of the parasite to determine its origin, which could provide valuable information on how it arrived into the country. But what the analysis of some data has already revealed is that there is no signs of any known resistance genes for the chemicals that are used overseas to control varroa. That's welcome news to Steve Fuller, president of the New South Wales Apiarists Association.
We haven't found them to be resistant to any miticides yet, which is good. We're just continuing to make sure we haven't missed anything like that. And that's a real positive, you know, so we can utilise a lot of different miticides, and it has a better impact on them.
And the availability of those miticides in Australia, do we have a lot of supplies if varroa mite does spread?
We've got a lot on order. It's caught us a little bit unawares of that because we didn't have a great big stockpile because it has a shelf life, and just getting it all now. So it is all coming in. I think we had 80,000 come in a couple of weeks ago, and we've got another container coming in. So I think we're pretty well covered with the miticide strips at the moment.
Yeah, so they come in a form of strips.
Yeah, they're strips. There's usually either two strips or four strips to a packet, and that's what you apply to your hive of bees.
And then how does that destroy the varroa mite?
Some people think it's like a fumes. It's not. The bees actually brush against the strips, and that coats them with a miticide, then the mite comes in contact with it and the mite dies. So that way it doesn't hurt the bees, and hopefully everything just targets mites.
Are we getting them imported from another country?
We bought all of New Zealand out at the moment.
Oh, did we?
Yeah.
And what sort of cost are these miticide strips for beekeepers?
If it comes to the situation that you have to put miticides in your hives, it's going to add about $50 to $80 a year extra. So that's just an ongoing cost now. If once it got declared endemic, then that's going to be a part of managing bees with varroa. So about $50 to $80.
Yeah, so what sort of impact will that have on honey production? Are we likely to see beekeepers managing more bees just so they get that same return of honey that they used to?
Everywhere in the world, the first few years, they do go down. Like managed bee colonies go down because we've got to learn how to manage them. But the problem is we're not aiming for that. If we can eradicate the bees and eradicate the mites, then we have a better control over our honey production, where our bees are going and all that. So at this point in time, I think we're a little bit too early to call and say, our honey production's going to go down, or our bee populations are going to go down. I think wait to see where we're at with the eradication, and then that'll actually turn out real good.
Steve Fuller there, President of the New South Wales Apiarists Association. And we do have a text in as well from Farmer Joe saying, nothing like almond grower self-interest pushing for more water in areas that were never meant to get that amount of water at the expense of irrigation above the choke and in the Goulburn. Thank you for your text, Farmer Joe. If you'd like to comment on anything that we're talking about on the Country Hour today, or give us some rainfall, text at 0467 842 722. Just shy of 12:30 now, so we're going to head to news headlines. Good afternoon, Michaela Ordolin.
Good afternoon. Police have found a body in floodwaters in Victoria's east. The discovery was made following reports a person and a dog were swept away by floodwaters in Traralgon Creek early yesterday morning. Police have cordoned off the area while the search and rescue squad works to recover the body, which is yet to be identified. A critical messaging system used by Bright SES in the northeast is being impacted by an overloading phone network during busy tourist periods. While calls for assistance are unaffected, members use a messaging system to say they're available or on their way to a job, which lowers response times, which can be dangerous. Pressure is mounting on both sides of state politics to commit to upgrading the dilapidated Daylesford Hospital in central Victoria. The 160-year-old hospital hasn't had a significant upgrade in more than 20 years and can no longer provide services, including maternity, because of the ageing facilities. The community has raised more than $100,000 to fund a master plan, but the total upgrade is expected to cost $75 million. Ballarat has recorded its lowest weekly total for COVID cases since the start of this year, with 796 infections last week, according to the latest State Health Department data. It's a major turnaround compared to 3 weeks ago, when the weekly total spiked above 1,700 cases. Portland Health District will reopen its maternity ward tomorrow after a five-month closure. The Southwest Victorian Hospital closed its maternity ward in March, citing a shortage of midwives. And the Australian Defence Force will conduct counter-terrorism exercises over the next 4 weeks, including some in regional Victoria. The ADF says it can't disclose the exact locations or dates of the training, but regional councils and police have been made aware, as have any landowners that will be affected. That's the latest in news. For more, visit abc.net.au/news.
Thank you for that, Michaela. Michaela Ordonan there with our regional news headlines. Let's head to the weather now. We've got Matthew Thomas on the line from the Bureau. Good afternoon, Matthew.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. What can you tell us about the weather situation across regional Victoria today?
So we've got a trough across Victoria this morning that was associated with a low pressure system that was near Tasmania. The low end has moved away out over the Tasman Sea. The trough's crossed the state and has likewise moved over the Tasman Sea. It did bring a reasonable amount of rainfall to the state as it crossed, but it's in the southwesterly stream behind that trough. We've just seen some showers push into southern Victoria, and the highest falls have been about the eastern ranges, and we've seen around 5 to 10 millimetres through that area, but also over parts of western South Gippsland. The ranges there, similar amounts, but generally less than 5 millimetres elsewhere on and south of the ranges, and just some isolated showers pushing north of the divide. And we won't see terribly much accumulate in the rain gauge for the remainder of today, just because a ridge of high pressure is pushing in from the west. So the shower activity in Western Victoria is going to ease as the afternoon and evening goes on, largely clear, and it's also going to ease back over Central and Eastern Victoria as well. That ridge of high pressure will move over the state tomorrow. We will see some morning fog and frost about northern parts of the state. As the ridge moves out over eastern Victoria and a northwesterly stream begins to develop about the southwest, we will see some showers push in late in the morning about the southwest, but just isolated showers into tomorrow about the southwest. They will push into central and western districts of the state in the evening. The northerly stream on Wednesday will begin to freshen over western and elevated parts during Wednesday, and that's ahead of an approaching cold front that will cross the state later on Thursday. So for much of Thursday, we'll just see some scattered showers about northern parts of the state, northern and western parts of the state, but we'll see that sort of fresh to strong northerly stream, particularly about the ranges, We are expecting to see quite gusty conditions about the ranges on Thursday, and some of that could push over into the southern districts during the day. But the shower activity will pick up during the afternoon as a cold front does approach, and it will tend to rain about the west and along the ranges. In terms of rainfall on Thursday, we're looking at 15 to 20 millimetres about the eastern ranges, 5 to 15 millimetres about northern parts of the state adjacent to the ranges, and also about the west, and around 2 to 5 millimetres elsewhere. That cold front will be sitting across western Victoria late on Thursday, and will finish crossing central and eastern Victoria early on Friday. But it will see a marked reduction in shower activity as it does cross the state, with a westerly stream behind the front being fairly dry and the showers really contracting back to the ranges or the coastal areas through Friday as that front does cross. But on Friday, we will see another 15 to 25 millimetres about the eastern ranges early in the morning, and 5 to 15 millimetres about west and south Gippsland and the northeast. But less than 5 millimetres elsewhere, and very little on Friday about the Mallee and the northern Wimmera. On Saturday, another cold front will just brush the south of Victoria, but it will tend the flow more southwesterly, so we'll see some scattered showers on and south of the ranges, and maybe just some isolated showers pushing north of the ranges, not terribly much in the rain gauge, 2 to 5 millimetres on and south of the ranges. And then on Sunday, a high pressure system will extend over the state, and not expecting to see terribly much precipitation out of that, but could see some fog and frost about northern parts. Another front will then cross on Monday.
And as in regards to the warnings we have been hearing out of Gippsland with the floods, is there any updates there, Matthew?
No, we've still got the flood warnings out, and the warnings that we do have out, we've got a moderate for the Latrobe River, a minor for Terrelgan Creek, a minor for Bunyip River. There's also a minor flood warning out for the Kiewa River and for the Murray River downstream of Hume Dam. We will see an increase in stream flow about the northeast from the rain that we are expecting on Thursday and Friday. And so we will be keeping an eye on what's happening with the rivers, particularly about the northeast of the state on Thursday and Friday with that increased rainfall about the northeast.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thank you for that, Matthew Thomas from the Weather Bureau there on the program today with all of the latest.
You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Jay McNaughton here with you today on the Country Hour, where it is 23 to 1. We have also got a text message in from Bill from Tabletop saying the sand slug is the Murray-Darling Basin Authority's spin to justify either dredging, widening or bypassing the Barmer Choke. It's their solution to the real problem of unregulated almond plantings and the whole country being held to ransom by South Australia's insistence it has the right to keep the lower lakes elevated at 0.9 of a metre above the natural level to keep their yacht keel... I think it's meant to say heels, yacht heels out of the mud. If you've got anything you'd like to contribute to the program today, 0467 842 722. In a bid to feed people ethically grown pork, a chef-turned-farmer has set up shop in Greenville, south of Ballarat. 50 pigs are currently being reared at the farm, which operates on what the owner calls a one-bad-day model, in which the pigs are bred at in a natural low-maintenance forest environment. I caught up with the owner of Ethical Swine, Rain Buckingham, at the Ballarat Farmers Market over the weekend, which is a hub for subscribing customers to collect their favourite cuts.
My rotational system is kind of the most ethical part about it. I spent a lot of time developing a system that allows me to give the pigs a large amount of space, but also move them quickly through different large amounts of space, really managing the way that the land is impacted by pigs being on it.
And how many pigs do you run?
Right now I have 50. I'm hoping to be up to my council limit of 100 next year.
Why are you doing what you're doing?
I was a chef in the States for about 13 years, and when I came here, I wanted to change jobs. And I realized that I didn't want to cook for people anymore, but I still wanted to feed people. And I wanted to feed people a better product. The history in the States of pork products and the way they are processed really is quite atrocious. And I wanted to show people what pork should be, how it can be delicious and flavorful and be good for you. And also that growing pigs is not necessarily something that makes the land worse. It's an idea that we have that pigs are terrible on the land, but if you let pigs do what pigs naturally do, they're actually not.
You mentioned the taste difference. Compare something from, say, Coles or Woolies, like a roast from Coles or Woolies, to something from Ethical Swine.
So most of the time, a roast from Coles or Woolies will have been pump brined with a saline solution, and that's how it keeps that really unnatural pink color for a long time on the shelves. That is just salt, and you can taste that in the meat. And also the breeds of the industrial pork, their flavor is denuded because they grow quickly. They are bred to grow in 4 to 6 months, so in that time they don't actually have time to become flavorful.
So how old are your pigs?
My pigs go to the abattoir between right now between 10 and 14 months, hoping to get that down to between 9 and 12 for optimum tenderness, but still full flavor.
How have you found the subscribe model for your business?
It's really good, because the concept of you subscribing means that you're going to pay for me to grow your pork for the rest of the year. So as the farmer, I get an influx of cash that allows me to manage where I need things to be and when I can buy things better than waiting until I've sold pork so then I can do the things I need to do. It's really nice, and it also allows people to kind of be a part of how their food is grown and where their food is grown and what happens with the food. You know, I find my members really get involved and are really, you know, interested in the day-to-day on the farm and love to come and visit. And it's a really great model.
With the situation happening in Indonesia at the moment with foot and mouth disease, is that something that you're concerned about?
Look, you're always concerned about all biosecurity issues, especially when it comes to pork, because a lot of the pork here in Australia is actually pork products are actually imported, and that's how that stuff gets in here. So yes, concerned, but because they've increased the rules around the biosecurity standards and stuff, so you were not allowed to move pigs as easily as we used to, and that's actually really good for especially small-scale farmers like me to keep biosecurity in check.
Founder and owner of Ethical Swine, Rayne Buckingham, speaking with me at the Ballarat Farmers Market over the weekend. And we have got some more correspondence on the text line 0467 842 722 about the situation with the Murray-Darling Basin. One here saying, boycott the water-wasting almond industry. They will suck our country dry, return no revenue, and then move on to the next state or country to do the same. 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
The Merino ram selling season has commenced, with some studs already recording big results, despite some headwinds for the industry. At Terrick West Pole Merinos, north of Bendigo, rams sold for an average of $3,700, up from more than $800 on the year before. Rural reporter Angus Verley caught up with stud principal Ross McGeckie at the Victorian State Merino Field Day yesterday.
We were over the moon, really, which you'd never quite know. We were hopeful that it'd go quite well, because we were reasonably confident we'd probably had the best lot of rams we've had. And the strength right through, I think, which proved the case that we did have the best lot of rams we've ever had. We, you know, the strength of the sale towards the end was much up on other years.
I think you averaged around $3,700, and that was up $900 on average on the year before. And the year before sale was, to that point, the best sale you'd had.
Yeah, it was. We were very happy with the last year's sale, and we're hopeful that we'd do as well again, and it's obviously exceeded our expectations by a fair bit.
So why such a big jump?
Oh, look, I think we were very fortunate. We had a few new clients. I think in some ways COVID's done us a favour, because there were a few people there that had been buying rams in other states that couldn't buy them in the last couple of years and couldn't get there, and they came to our sale and bought rams, and they've been very happy with them. And they came back in quite a bit of strength, and were really, really looking to get a few pretty good rams. And it's just amazing that people are prepared to pay $5,000 or $6,000 for commercial rams. And I think that's with our average. It wasn't pushed up by a very high price ram. It was just the strength of the sale from start to finish.
Is it surprising to you then, Ross, that Merino rams are selling so well, when on the flip side, some people are going out of Merinos, the area planted to crop seems to be increasing all the time, and yet you've just had your best ever ram sale?
Yeah, look, I think the great thing about the whole rural industries at the moment is the strength right through all, whether it be cattle or Merino sheep for meat and wool or the terminals for lamb. The strength right through is encouraging people into the industry, and more young kids coming back into the industry than have been in the last 20 or 30 years. And I think the other thing is that the number of people that are still in Merino sheep are very welded on, I guess. They love their Merino sheep. And
so those who are still in it now are the committed ones?
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think that's they are very committed, and they're becoming a lot more professional. If, I don't know whether that's the right word, but they're prepared to pay a lot more money than they would have a few years ago for the right animals. And that's why days like today are so important. And you see that the top end of the industry, there's some terrific sheep, and people are prepared to come out, and they are prepared to pay well for them.
Speaking of terrific sheep, I think 33 studs here today, including your own. What do you make of the lineup?
Oh, look, the overall standard is terrific. There's a range of types and wool types and sheep types through the sheep that are here, and that suits a range of. We're not all trying to do the same thing. We're not all trying to. We don't all come from the same areas, and so there's a range of things that people are looking for. Some people are looking for bigger wool cuts and pushing that way. Other people are pushing more into the meat side with a good wool. So. It gives people, and that's why we have days like today. People can go around and see what's there and what they like and what suits them.
Foot and mouth disease. It's been a talking point here today, but perhaps just anecdotally from my perspective, not so much as at previous events a couple of weeks back, Sheepvention and then the Sheep Show before that, where that seemed to be all anyone was talking about. So do you think perhaps that fear factor of FMD has dissipated a little bit?
Oh, look, I think the talking point of these sort of things, and it was certainly being ramped up a few weeks ago, and I don't think that's getting the balance right between getting people aware of problems, but not going too far over the top. It's all a very, very fine line to get, and I suppose initially when they start talking about foot and mouth disease, sends a shudder up the spine of everyone. And so it's a matter of being rational about it. I mean, foot and mouth's been in China and Indonesia for all my life, so we need to be careful. And ramping up the idea of being more careful at the airports and things is not a bad thing. But on the other hand, you just don't want to scare the hell out of people. So it's a matter of getting that balance correct.
A difficult balance to get right. That was Ross McGeckie from Terrick West Pole Merino speaking with Angus Verley yesterday. Got some more people chiming in about the situation with the Murray-Darling Basin. We've got one here from Doggy, the dairy farmer, saying, totally agree with the text messaging about the Barmer choke. I'm a farmer on the Goulburn system who still owns his water. If I was to plant my farm to almonds, Goulburn Murray Water would tell me we can't deliver that amount of water because of system restraints. Doggy says that it is not the same for the lower. Is it not the same for the lower Murray? And if we can't deliver that amount of water, it should never have been allowed to keep developing more. Thank you for that, Doggy. If you'd like to have a chat, 0467 842 722.
You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Jane McNaughton here on the Country Hour today, where it is 11 to 1. How often do you sit back and think about how far we've come in agriculture? No matter whether you've been farming for 10 years or 40 years, you've likely lived through some dramatic changes in whatever industry that you're in. Robert Green is a former Farmer of the Year and has been a part of the apple industry in South Australia's Adelaide Hills for his entire life. He took reporter Luke Radford on a trip back through his career.
Well, I guess I was probably at birth given the right or the work path of being an apple orchardist. I was the fourth generation apple grower, and I guess my destiny was somewhat decided for me, but these days it's a bit different. But you know, I left school, came home and worked with my father and grandfather, and I guess did my apprenticeship, and then started to sort of question the way that they were going about things that to some degree hadn't changed for 60 or 70 years.
Now that's a big point, because when we have that kind of changeover of generations, it can get quite how should we put it, tetchy between sort of those that come before and the new upcoming ones with the new ideas. How did that transition go for you?
I think it would be fair to say that I learnt the skill of debating, and I guess I had to be able to put up a convincing argument, and in the end I think my father's probably got sick of me badgering him, and he offered me the back paddock and said, you can get up there and try this newfangled stuff if you want to.
Well, speaking of newfangled, in the time you've had it, you nearly tripled the amount of trees per hectare to start off with. Then you did it again a few years ago as well, including all kinds of new management techniques, as you were mentioning, with trellises and the like. What was that whole journey like?
I think at the time it was just a case of you were doing what you felt was right, and I guess we had some inspirations along the way and experiences. I was very, very fortunate to be able to travel both internationally and nationally, but then in a few latter years internationally, and especially when you venture into places into Europe, their society and industry seem to be 10 or 15 years a bit further advanced than us. Land and resource constraints and labour, the cost of labour, those sort of things influenced them before us, so it was a good place to go and see how they adapted to change.
So you think we're playing catch-up then?
Oh, well, I think we just progressed slower than what their society did. And I don't know that we're necessarily playing catch-up. I think that there's plenty of examples of apple growers in this country that are at or above what you might consider world best practice in terms of production per hectare and overall efficiency. You know, there's some very, very good operators.
Speaking of operations, one of the big challenges you faced back in Lenswood in the Adelaide Hills is, of course, the availability of water in that section of the world can be quite tricky at times, especially during summer, which does get quite dry. Now, you had to kind of almost self-develop the technique you've been using, really. And what was that like?
Yeah, well, it was one of trial and, explore and try to get a bit of advice from particularly people from this region, where I think they had a better sense of water use efficiency perhaps before we did. But I think trial and error once again. It depends a little bit on the personality that you are, and if you're into wanting to research and sort of investigate things. I think that's probably just the sort of person I was, and I explored some of these concepts, and you put in a little bit of a trial, and it might only just be a small scale block, 1 year, 2 years. You play around and you assess, what you're achieving from it. So, it was research and development at home level, yeah.
So it was a drip irrigation technique. How's that evolved since you first put it in?
I think some of the major learnings would have been regarding filtration. A lot of the early systems in our district probably weren't well researched and thought out and were sort of only half a system. So I think filtration and the actual management of the system to keep it clean, along with obviously monitoring and scheduling. So it was a case of really trying to understand where that water was moving in your root profile and what the trees were using, and trying to, in some cases, preempt what they were going to require and manage a scheduling system so that they weren't left wanting.
Robert Green from Lensfield in South Australia's Adelaide Hills, speaking there with Luke Radford.
$70, thank you.
Here you go.
So we don't usually head to the Deniliquin markets, but today we're making an exception. Lamb suckers are making news in the Riverina today, and Jenny Kelly joins us now with the latest. Jenny, how many lamb suckers were there today at Deniliquin, and how did they go?
There was about 2,000 suckers come out today. This was the first ones we've seen for the season. They sold pretty well. They probably were dearer than Bendigo yesterday. They made from $188 to a top of $215, and that was for crossbred suckers around the 22 to 26 kilo mark. So they were working out around 800 to 850 cents for a ballpark average of 830 cents. I say ballpark because at this stage of the season, it's still uncertain about yields and what carcass results buyers are going to get from them. The skin issue is also unknown at the moment. A lot of the buyers are still uncertain how to value lamb skins, sucker skins.
So do you think at the end of the day these prices are indicative of what producers can expect this spring?
This could be at the higher end. As we go forward and more numbers come out, the pressure on buyers will ease for numbers. What we did see here today, we had 12 buyers at the rails, including both supermarkets, and that's double what normally turns up at Deniliquin, and that's because of the quality and the numbers that are now starting to come out. But as the suckers start to run and more come out, there won't be so much pressure on buyers to get into these top trade weight lambs. So looking at the way the market's been tracking in the last month, you would probably expect the prices to ease off as numbers build.
And just briefly, how did the other runs of lambs go at the sale today?
There were some very good old lambs too off feed, and they were dearer as well. And that probably come down to the level of competition that was at the sale yards. The very good fed lambs made from $190 to a top of $240. And they were sitting more in the sort of 750 to 800 cents a kilo mark, which is a bit stronger than what we've been seeing as well.
Brilliant. Jenny Kelly, thank you so much for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thank you.
Jenny Kelly there, joining us from Deniliquin. Now, let's stick with sheep. But let's head to Ballarat with Shiona Lamb.
Good afternoon, Jane. Lamb supply decreased to 7,800. The quality varied from plain to very good. Not all the usual buying group were present, and not all were fully active. Strong competition from local processors seen heavy lambs increase $4 to $8 a head to top $259, while the trade weight slipping $3 to $9 a head, light lambs were to 20 cheaper in places. Store buyers present were quiet, and lambs back to the paddock and to feed on made $40 to $144 a head. Light lambs under 18 kilos to suit MK orders sold $58 to $126. Trade lambs 18 to 22 sold $124 to $179. 22 to 24 kilo lambs sold $173 to $193. And 24 to 26 kilos made from $192 to $205 a head, with an average of $7.30 to $7.80 cents a kilo carcass weight. Heavy export lambs, 26 to 30 kilos, made 214 to 229, and over 30 kilos sold 237 to 259, with an average range of 735 to 770 cents a kilo carcass weight. Heavy merino wethers presented in excellent condition made $145 to $180 a head. This is Shiona Lamb at Ballarat for MLA.
Thanks, Shiona. Now let's head up to the northeast and go to Wodonga with Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. 505 cattle sold to most of the usual winter buying group. However, two major processors did not operate across feeder or export categories this week. Quality was mostly secondary, with a few quality pens of trade cattle. Restockers and backgrounders also feedlots bidded with confidence. Restocking weaner steers, 560 to 565. Feeder steers, 330 to 400 kilo, jumped 18 cents, 506 to 626. Medium weights slipped back 14 cents, quality related, 470 to 520. Trade steers picked up 6, 520 to 575. Trade heifers, 465 to 568. Heavy kill steers bounced up 40 cents, 490 to 530. Heavy feeder steers, 500 to 600 kilo, 500 to 532. Heavy heifers with shape, 410 to 485, up 45 cents. Cows powered ahead, 30 cents, for 378 to 430. And the middle run, very few to quote, 320 to 340. Leanne Dax, MLA.
Cheers, Leanne. And finally to Shepparton with Tim Delaney.
Good afternoon. There was a larger yarding at Shepparton for approximately 730 export. 300 trade cattle greeted the usual winter buying gallery that followed the market. Restockers and feeders created some extra competition for suitable cattle. with improved quality offering from average to good with more Vela pens. Prices were mostly of a dearer trend with the demand lifting. Younger cattle suiting restock and feeders were from 10 to 20 cents dearer, with some sales to processors affirmed to 10 cents higher. Growing cattle were from 5 to 20 cents stronger. Cows sold from 20 to 30 cents dearer. Good quality steer Vela sold from 512 to 590 cents. Restock is paying to 605 cents a kilogram. Heifers selling from mainly 485 to 570 cents. Trade yearling steers made mostly between 500 to 593 cents. There was some plainer types that sold from 409 to 485. Yearling heifers sold to 570 cents. And restockers and feeders paid mostly between 424 to 570 cents for their yearlings. Good quality grown heifers made from 410 to 460 cents. Grown steers were mostly between 390 up to 508 cents. Frisian manufacturing steers sold to 390 cents a kilogram. And this has been Tim Delaney reporting for MLA Shepparton.
Thanks, Tim. That's all we've got time on the program for today. I hope you have a great weekend. We're coming up to the news now at 1 o'clock.